My guest today is the legendary singer-songwriter Dan Hill. Without a doubt, you've all heard his signature hit, Sometimes When We Touch. The song has been recognized as one of the top 100 songs of the century and one of the top 100 most played songs of all time by BMI. A song that Dolly Parton says is her favorite song of all time, and she wishes that she had written it herself. Well, Dan's other hits include Can't We Try, number one Billboard AC Record of the Year in 1987, which spent 29 weeks on the Billboard charts, and Never Thought That I Could Love, another number one adult contemporary record, and along with I Fall All Over Again, All I See Is Your Face, Carmelia, and even Unborn Heart, all reached Billboard or Record World Top number three positions and remain staples of adult contemporary radio stations around the world. Collectively, Dan's music amasses well over 1 million listeners per month on Spotify. Nominated for a Grammy for Best Male Vocal and a winner of a Grammy as a co-producer of Seduces Me on Celine Dion's 32-plus million-selling Falling Into You album. And he is the winner of 5 Juno Awards, the Harold Moon Award, Queen Elizabeth II Platinum Jubilee Medal recipient, and of course, inducted into the Canadian Songwriters Hall of Fame Award in 2021. So ladies and gentlemen, let's welcome one of the most iconic singers of our time and one of the most prolific songwriters as well, the one and the only Dan Hill. Welcome, Dan.
So great to be here talking to you. Thank you for having me.
Well, it is an absolute honor, and I have to say, I read your book as part of my research for our interview, because sometimes I think you even have the most incredible backstory than the one that the public actually has seen and heard. But I have to ask you, because I read that your father chose to live in Canada due to its subtlety to racism versus America's blatant racism back in the 50s and 60s. How do you think your life and career would have turned out if you were born and raised in the United States?
Well, that's a really, really great question. I was raised in an area that was a very fertile area for highly creative and musical people. And one of the reasons I was so fortunate to become so successful so young was meeting a kid my age who was a genius with synthesizers before anybody even knew what a synthesizer was. And it was our collaboration. He is sort of the producer, me as the singer-songwriter, that enabled me to have that big first hit album. So I don't know if I would have met those kind of people living somewhere in America. So my dad, in a very calculating way, chose an area of Canada that was where there were a lot of very, very high achievers. And so I think maybe it wouldn't have happened. That being said, though, I was born with an amazing musicality. It was just in my veins. So I would have to say that it probably would have happened anyway, but maybe not as quickly outside of Canada.
You know, I found a statement in your book that I found kind of funny, but it also shows your passion and it showed your ambition, that you were surprised that you hadn't made it yet and you were only 18 years old.
Yes, I was a very, very ambitious kid. I mean, I knew from the age of 5 that I was going to be a singer. You know, I think really that's an advantage in a business like the music business. The sooner you can figure out you want to do it, the better. If you've graduated from college with a PhD in history and you're 29, in my opinion, it's just too late. So my dad was the most confident guy I'd ever known. And so I think I kind of inherited that confidence. And I assumed it was going to happen for me. And by the age of 18, I felt that I wasn't living up to my potential.
Wow. You know, your book, the book is really not just about your career, even though you do cover your career very deeply, the ins and outs, the ups and downs of being a star. But you really highlight your relationship with your father. And like you said, your father was a very confident man, Was he, for me, when I was reading your story, was he too hard on you, or was that his way of showing you love?
Well, that's a very interesting question. I would say both. In some ways, he was maybe unnecessarily hard on me, and he did have a mean streak. But on the other hand, he you know, blasted into my system that for you to be black, you know, and uneducated and unskilled, you are doomed. And you know, for my father as a black man, the only way to possibly transcend racism was to be highly educated. And so he just didn't come out of a world where you could make a living as a musician, you know. So when I was dropping out of high school to make it as a singer-songwriter, he thought I was doomed to poverty and family disgrace, because he just didn't understand that world at all. Later on, as I say in the book, he understood that he was wrong. His classic line was, "I underestimated you."
Well, you know, that line, when I was reading that particular chapter, really kind of brought a tear to my eye, because that was a couple of years before your father had passed, and he said that he underestimated you due to the success of your musical career. And, you know, and I've talked to other recording artists who are much younger, and you know, their parents would be like, "Hey, you know, get a real job, you know, make sure you have a plan B." And, but you were so ambitious, you focused on really, truly making it, but you showed signs, you stepped out in faith a lot. I mean, even getting on the phone or looking up in the phone book, how many record companies are there in Toronto? And you stepped out and sent out demos trying to get a deal, and one step at a time, you made it to the top.
I think in some ways it was perhaps an easier time. In some ways it was more understandable that people thought you were absolutely nuts to try to make it as a successful sort of pop singer. Because they're just, now there are all these shows like The Voice and The Mask and all that stuff. And being a successful singer is more normalized now, you know. Whereas back in the early 70s, it was thought of as, it was kind of unprecedented. Really, there was no one I ever grew up with who wanted to do this, you know. And so in some ways, you could understand why people would think it was a strange, bizarre choice. But in other ways, the early 70s, it was the golden era for singer-songwriters. You got James Taylor, Cat Stevens, Elton John, Carole King, Carly Simon, Neil Young, Gordon Lightfoot. And in some ways, it really was I didn't know this at the time, but it was really the perfect time for someone like me to try to make a mark.
Well, who were your musical influences growing up, especially being in Canada?
My dad only listened to black jazz, you know, so, and my dad ruled the house. He was a very authoritarian, dominant force. So my musical heroes in the first music I learned to sing, Count Basie, Duke Ellington, Sarah Vaughan, Ella Fitzgerald, Billie Holiday, Joe Williams, Ray Charles, you know, I had no idea about, say, rock and roll, frankly, until the Beatles hit Ed Sullivan in 1964. You know, the one white singer I listened to in love was Frank Sinatra. But because a lot of those songs had kind of a bittersweet melancholia to them, I think that had an effect on the kind of melancholy that often streaked through my songs. Also, those songs were really, really thick in storytelling. I Left Her in Monterey, for example. I mean, what a story, you know. So my whole concept of what love and romance was as a little boy all came through what these people were doing in their songs. You know, I mean, it was a total education for me as well as a musical influence.
Well, you know, you bring up, you know, how to tell a story through a song. You know, I'm thinking of Gordon Lightfoot, Dan Fogelberg. They were the type that, you know, could really write a song that was telling a story. And it was the type of writing that they did that we didn't mind listening to it on the radio and singing it over and over again, versus some people writing what I would call a story song, where you know the ending and then you would hear it about a few times, but then you didn't really want to hear it again because it's kind of like watching a movie and you already know the ending. But with you, Gordon Lightfoot, Dan Fogelberg, there were songs that just came out of all of you that we could just sing over and over again. And You really leaned towards those ballads, didn't you?
Yes, again, circling back to my childhood, because those were, Sinatra songs were basically ballads, right? Or even, Harry Belafonte, I had to leave a little girl in Mexico, sounds of laughter everywhere, and the nightingale sing to and fro. Again, slow, sad, with very, very powerful song, storytelling and imagery.
Definitely. Now, you were only 19 years old when you wrote Sometimes When We Touch. I have listened to that song so many times in the last few days, really getting the essence of that song. And it kind of dawned on me, even in your book kind of backed this up, because even someone that you wrote about in your book said, there's no way this kid wrote this song. You know, how old is this person? Because it would sound like somebody 30 or 40 years old writing a song like that. Were you an old soul when you were younger?
I think part of it was there's a really, really a prevailing atmosphere in my family that we had to be really, really terrific wordsmiths. And even as a little boy, my dad would say, if you want something, you have to write a letter about it. If you want to have a kid, and you write a letter saying why you deserve the kid, what your responsibilities would do, this kid. If you want to raise your allowance, if you want to have a haircut like the Beatles, write me a letter. And so, and make it persuasive and articulate and coherent. So I think a lot of it was, I was always more comfortable writing words than actually speaking them. And so I would process my feelings. It's funny because these days psychiatrists say you should journal, right? Well, when I was growing up, there was no such thing as journaling, but in a way, songwriting was my form of journaling.
Well, how many songs would you write? I mean, as a teenager of course it became a hit when you were 19. I mean, how many songs were you writing every single day?
Yes, I was signed to RCA Records at the age of 18, which was a terrific jump into the world of music. But even though I was being tipped as being this future successful artist, I was still just making a buck 89 an hour, right? Circling back to the fact that I had no university education, I realized that my only out was writing songs. So I would come home from work every day, and I immediately, run to my guitar and start writing because I knew that was my ticket. And I would think that if I didn't have that job, maybe if I had a cushier job with better pay, maybe I wouldn't have been so determined to find music to get me out of there.
Well, you went back to the civil service job for a while. Was that just to pay bills?
Yes. I mean, I think what happened was I was starting to get cuts around 19. The great black jazz singer Cleo Lane, for example, Harry Belafonte had already flown me to New York to talk about doing my songs. Jose Feliciano was about to cut one of my songs. So even though things were looking really good for me as a songwriter at that time, as you know, it takes a long time. Even if someone cuts your song, by the time you make the money, it could easily be 3 or 4 years, right? So even though there was this buzz happening, it was like living a kind of a schizophrenic life. On one hand, you're being hailed as this unusually gifted, precocious songwriter. Next, you're literally going to the department, just handing out mail. And so I would go to bed at night saying, well, what am I? But to go back to your earlier question, yes, I was probably writing about a song a week. I was probably writing 50 songs a year.
Well, you wrote your mega hit, Sometimes When We Touch, to win a girl over, but it actually landed like a lead balloon, but the rest of the world fell in love with you and your song instead. Is it still amazing how monstrous that this song has become over the years?
Yes. A couple of things. I kind of sensed when I was writing the song, I wrote it over 2 days, so every 2 days, Wednesday, Thursday, back from the civil service, bam, my guitar. I knew somehow that I was coming up with some lyrics that were highly original. For example, Just Another Writer Trapped With My Truth, A Hesitant Prize Fighter, I knew that I was stumbling onto things that I'd never heard before in a song. So I knew I'd hit some uncharted territory in a really good way. But that being said, you know, first of all, before you have an international hit, you have no idea what that's like. There's no way anybody can explain to you the experience of having a hit that breaks all around the world. The other strange thing was, unlike now, if you put out a single, it's bam, right around the world immediately. Back in the 70s, you know, it was a hit in Canada, then 3 months later it was a hit in the States, then 3 months later it was a hit in Europe, then 3 months later it was a hit in Asia. I was literally chasing that record around the world in 3 month increments. And even if your song is a hit, you know, let's face it, culture, pop culture for the most part, is sort of disposable. Kind of think about Mr. T, for example, or Don Johnson. You know, a hit song usually has its cycle of 3 months and then you forget it, it's on to the next hit song. There's no way in the world that you can foresee whether this hit song is going to become a classic. So, A, you know, I had no idea it was going to be a hit song and how it would totally, absolutely, you know, upend my life and totally change my life forever. But I certainly had no idea of its staying power or that it was going to be so cut by so many people. Because at first people didn't cut. I think they were kind of scared of the song because it was kind of new, you know, very unusual for a man to express that kind of, and I think they were a little bit intimidated by my vocal performance. So the first year or so, no one was cutting. They were going, "What? Where did this come from?" And then, bam! Suddenly, it was like Dolly Parton, Tammy Wynette, Tina Turner, and then when all those covers started coming in, I started to see that maybe this song was going to be around for a while.
Back in the day, especially back in early to mid to late 70s, to me, that's the best era of music that we will ever see or ever have. And you contributed a lot to that. For you, when this song came out and it started catching on, this is a big hit song. When did you start hitting the road to tour off this album?
Well, in the first place, as I said, it was a hit 3 months earlier in Canada. So I was already performing in Canada, you know, almost nonstop. I also had kind of a cult following in the States because I'd had two earlier albums that had done quite well and been played in L.A. and New York. So I was already performing quite a bit in America. I actually toured with the great Gino Vannelli in 76. Once that single hit, that was it. I was performing probably 200 nights a year.
Well, all right, this song came out in 1977, 1978, and you actually called it the zenith of your career, but it was also the darkest and the saddest. Why?
Well, I've been in a very, very deep, loving relationship since I was 15. And just as that song came out in Canada, there was a hellacious breakup and my girlfriend left me for a track coach. And it was just like, I was just really, really devastated. And it was ironic because suddenly it seemed like the world was in love with me. And the song did seem to appeal a lot to women, you know. But at the same time, the woman who meant the most to me had rejected me. So it was this really strange disconnect of being successful and so-called loved by the public, but rejected by the woman whose love you needed the most. So it was a terribly sad time for me. I medicated my sadness with work. You know, I was just, because if I wasn't performing, I was writing. If I wasn't writing, I was recording. You know, so the cycle of writing your own songs, recording them, and then touring.
I think it was nonstop, wasn't it?
And I think that's why, you know, the tendency tends to be that pop stars are young, right? They usually hit in their early 20s. Think James Taylor, 21, Carly Simon, 22, you know, Elton John, 21. I think part of the reason is there's no way in your 40s that you can sustain that kind of schedule. Barry White had a huge comeback in the 40s. We were signed to the same label, actually. And so he tried to hit the same tour schedule as he did in the 20s. He was in the hospital in a week. You know, so I think that it's a young man's game in that respect, because you got to be so many places at once, as Joni Mitchell put it, to stoke the star-making machinery, you know. And if you're not willing to do that, there are all these other people that look like they're going to have a hit that are. So you have to be out there hustling every second.
Oh yeah, I mean, and then you had these other years, but then in 1987, you had the comeback with hit songs like "Can't We Try," "Never Thought That I Could Love." But I have to ask, because with the song "Can't We Try," how did you get to keep Vonda Shepard on the record since Ronnie Spector didn't have the range?
Well, that was a big issue for me because I knew that Vonda her vocal performance was absolutely extraordinary. And part of that was just absolute luck because I'd already auditioned 15 female singers to do that song and they couldn't do it. It's a very demanding song to sing. But remember, Vonda was 22 at that time, totally unknown. She actually came up in her bicycle, so in her bicycle shorts, she went in and cut the vocal. And we're going, where did this person come from? And then the person who was the president of the label, kind of I was assigned to, wanted Ronnie Spector to take Vonda's place because he thought that Ronnie Spector, who just had that comeback with the Eddie Money "Take Me Home Tonight," would have this kind of comeback that Tina. That yeah, it was Tina Turner had, and that all she needed was a hit song. So his idea was to piggyback Ronnie Spector on this hit song, so that we would both have hits. And I pleaded and begged and told him not to do it, not to do it. It was a big mistake because she wasn't going to beat Vonda, and he just said, "Just do it with it," you know. And so I had to go in the studio, and I got to tell you, Ronnie Spector was a. I was very thrilled to meet her for obvious reasons. She's like a hero. But she reminded me of someone that came out of retirement to say box again or play football, and then it became entirely apparent that they were just too old. She just did not have the range, or the tone that she had when she was young. And it's actually a very rangy song. And I had some issues with her manager who demanded that I don't coach her too much, you know. So it was a very unusual and strange session. Thankfully, then the president of the record company could see that there was no way that Ronnie's vocal was going to be better than Vonda's. Also, there was talk of there was talk of Gladys Knight doing the song, and of course I'm a huge fan of Gladys Knight's. So, but looking back at it, I was very, very lucky that Vonda came around. And of course, I think it was in the 90s and she hit huge with the Ally McBeal soundtrack. So I've been very lucky at finding singers before they become hits. I was working with Celine before anyone knew who she was. I was working with Deborah Cox, who had that big hit with Arista. I always find these unusual talents just before they become discovered.
I found it interesting reading your book, and literally, I thought my jaw was going to drop on the floor because when you had to replace Vonda with another singer because you were getting so many people coming to you wanting to do live performances. Maybe it was on television or at events, and because you were on one label, Vonda was on another. Because back in the day, people wouldn't be pairing up people on separate labels. Now it's like no big deal because everybody can benefit from that. But my eyes popped out of my head when I read that you found a girl to take over Vonda's part, but I want you to tell the rest of the story.
Well, what happened is that Vonda recorded the vocal, in say 1986, right? And then the song was a massive hit basically in the spring of 1987 in America. But then Vonda decided that she didn't want to sing the song with me because she was interested in pursuing her own career because as a songwriter, and to Vonda's credit, she's a very, very, very gifted songwriter, an incredible keyboard player, and a great singer. So therefore she didn't want to be, tied to that song or to me, or to be just the singer and not the songwriter. And then there were TV shows that wouldn't want me unless Vonda, the original singers on the record, Johnny Carson said, "You get Vonda, then I'll have you on singing 'Can't We Try.'" And so I was in trouble because I couldn't get that exposure that I needed to keep pushing that hit. So my product manager at Columbia Records said, "I think there's a singer that could be great for you, and no one knows who she is. She only speaks French. She's well known in French Quebec." And so, 18-year-old Celine Dion came into my house to audition to see if she could replace Fonda. And she was so nervous that she was shaking all over, couldn't speak. But the minute she started saying, "Can't we try?" within like the first two lines, I go, "Oh my God," you know. And so, in a funny way, you know how people always say sometimes the things that are disappointments or rejections or failures end up really forming you into a great success. So, this rejection I felt from Vonda, you know, opened this door that never would have been opened. So, because really, not only was Celine doing a great job replacing Vonda, but had I not known Celine at that time, there's no way that she would have cut Seduces Me and allow me to produce her vocals. So again, the rejection turned into a positive in the case of Vonda and Celine and Can't We Try and Seduces Me.
You know, I was surprised when I read the story about Seduces Me and having to jump through all of those hoops and jump over those fences to get this song on Celine's album, Falling Into You, which, it's like you said in the book, it's like 100 songwriters are just trying just to get a song on this record for her to sing, regardless if it becomes a hit or not, because whatever hit she brings out, everybody on that album is going to financially benefit, so everybody was fighting for their space. I went back and looked at that album, and I'm thinking, okay, if all of these people were fighting for a slot on Falling Into You, and then I look at the list, and there's at least two songs that are cover songs, which actually surprised me that she had on her record, because she was still young at that time.
Yes, she was.
You know, like she's saying, you know, we just lost Eric Carmen. And so she's saying All By Myself. And I was like, wow, all of these people trying to get a slot on here. And again, credit to you, because you met Celine when she was 15, still had an incredible voice at that age. Did you see any superstardom in her at that time?
Yes, I did. Yeah. Definitely, A, in her voice, and B, when I performed with her, you know, maybe I didn't realize it during the performance, but looking, for example, there's a, you can find Celine Dion and I singing Can't We Try at a great big Sony Records convention in 87, or there are other, you know, things you can, where you can watch Celine and I sing the song together, and her stage presence was masterful, you know, so I'm not at all surprised. Also, she was one of those people that was 100% disciplined, right? Not only was she disciplined, if she was going to meet you in the studio to sing a duet with you, because she recorded another duet with me on another album, she would be there half an hour early with all the lyrics written out, all the parts written out. She was the quintessential performer, kind of like, you know, the stories about Wayne Gretzky and Michael Jordan. They were always the people that practiced the most, right? So not only was she incredibly disciplined, also she was unbelievably kind and friendly and genuinely warm. So if she met you, say, at a record convention, say, or a radio convention, and you mentioned your two children, if she met you a year later, she not only would remember you had two children, but she'd remember the names of your two children. So it was a combination of A, amazing talent, B, incredible discipline, determination. See, a person who is genuinely warm and kind.
You know, I thought it was
find that combination in people.
No, not. And still, even at the superstardom level, you don't really see that a whole lot. But I kind of laughed because in your book, you had played the song back to your father, and your father goes, "She has a French accent." And I laughed. And I went back to listen to her early recordings, and I was like, yeah, but that's what set her apart. And she never really lost that to me.
That's true, because when I was producing her, often her managers would say, her manager being, well, Renee, her husband, who sadly has passed, but he says, get rid of her French accent, get rid of her French. And, you know, and I was saying, no, you know, I mean, part of becoming a successful singer is your voice has to sound authentic. If you come across a great singer, but she sounds kind of like Whitney Houston, you know, in my opinion, think of all the great singers you like. Who else sounds like Sinatra? Or who else sounds like Tina or Rod Stewart? You know, so you're exactly right. That was one of the things that made her special.
Well, you know, you wrote, there was a lyric that you wrote in your book. Lord, don't let this crazy world make a jukebox out of me. Did that become a reality to you in the late 1980s when the 80s rolled around?
Well, I would say that, you know, for me, that was a metaphor to... Back in the 60s and 70s, there was this term that's never used anymore. It was called selling out. You're probably too young to remember this term. Like, for example, a sellout in the 60s would be someone who sold their song to a commercial. Now, culturally, that's not selling out. Selling a song to a commercial just helps immortalize the song, not to mention the money that you make. And so I was afraid of selling out. And so becoming a jukebox was the metaphor for selling out. You know, that being said, you know, sometimes, you know, when I was singing, sometimes when we touched, by the time I sung it for the 150,000th time, perhaps then I was feeling like a bit of a jukebox.
Yeah, but, you know, we thank people like you for writing these songs that we will sing forever, be a part of our lives, be a part of our memories. But for you, how hard was it to go from singer to writing songs for some of the biggest artists in the world?
Well, I actually really love the transition for a lot of reasons. To me, it's kind of like being, let's say, a professional basketball player, say, to becoming a basketball coach, you know. Because the singers can relate a lot more to you because they know that you've had the experience of being a highly successful singer. Also, if you want a singer to sing something and you sing yourself, I could just say, Celine, sing this, and I'd sing it in the air. They get it. The other thing I liked about it was you could cross genres and styles as a writer the way you can't as a singer. I mean, I've had songs that have been cut that are jazz songs, pure country songs, Euro dance songs. I can't sing jazz and I can't sing country, but as a writer, I can jump into all those different domains. So also, you know, although sometimes when we talk, it may have opened the door for me as a songwriter, the artists always want to hear new songs, you know? And so you're not always thinking about your past songs. You know, it's more creative in a way because you're trying to come up with new songs. And again, it's very easy to form a bond with the singers you're working with.
Well, was it the song Seduces Me? Was that the one that led you in to start songwriting for other stars?
Well, you know, I had a huge cover hit with the brilliant late Michael Masser. And we wrote a song called In Your Eyes. It was a big hit for George Benson, later for Jeffrey Osborne, and then for many, many other black artists. So that was a pretty big record for me, I think, back in 1983. And I think what happened was the black artists became aware of me more quickly than the Caucasian artists. And between Sometimes When You Touch and In Your Eyes, you know, at that point, there were a lot of black artists looking for my songs. That being said, once Seduce Me happened, it was like Sometimes When We Touch all over again, but in the context of being a big songwriter. At that point, then everybody wanted to work with me and everybody wanted to hear my songs. Another big advantage is if you're an artist, you can spend 2 or 3 years just putting together one album. And then that album can come out and bomb. And then you're thinking, oh my God, that was 3 years. Whereas as a songwriter, you know, you may have 25 different cuts by 25 different acts in 1 year. And all you need is one out of those 25 to do well, and it's paid for itself. So your odds of hitting financially are far greater as a successful songwriter.
Yeah, and then when you started writing songs for some of the biggest country artists out there, Alan Jackson, Reba McEntire, I mean, the list goes on. But during that era of country, and you had stated this in your book as well, and you nailed it, that's when that pop influence was really coming into country music. So for you, that made the transition pretty easy there, didn't it?
It was remarkable. And as you well know, a lot of being accepted in certain realms of the music business is if you have a champion. And Keith Stigo, who's one of the most successful songwriter producers of all time, he actually discovered Alan Jackson. He wrote songs like We're in This Love Together for Al Jarreau and Sexy Eyes for Dr. Hook. So he has a great pop background. But Keith Stigo kind of went to all the country and said, this guy's great, you know. And the reason he's going to be great in country is he's writing from a different standpoint than all the other country writers. And then I think we wrote three songs, and two out of three songs became massive hits. So it was a combination of a lot of things. You're right, the time was right, because, again, pop, you know, was infiltrating country music, but also the fact that I had such a brilliant champion in my corner in country music, who was also a very gifted songwriter, Keith Stigo. So then it was like ridiculous. I was getting a lot of country covers.
You know, that time of country, to me, that's when, and I know there were traditionalists that were really kind of criticizing the whole pop flavor, but that era of country, that's when the pop flavor into country really worked. It had a very great commercial sound. It was accepted by, you know, songs would cross over. And country music became a juggernaut during that time. Now, here we are, 2024, and there's a lot of criticism going across country that, oh, country's just way too pop. But the pop flavor now is completely different. And I find that when you had all of these songs back with Alan and Reba and Mark Wills with I Do, those songs we sang, we loved, we wanted to hear them over and over again. They stuck with us. We still remember those songs. I don't feel that and see that with today's country. But do you see that there's a big difference between those two eras?
Yes, although of course the cover of Fast Cars, you know, Tracy Chapman.
Now that was the best cover, and to have her come in with Luke to sing that, oh my gosh, I still play that video.
Yeah, that's pretty amazing, and that makes me kind of, you know, realize that there are still some exciting elements. And yes, their performance on the Grammys is extremely, extremely moving, and the cover. I'm sorry, for some reason I watch this video all the time, but it's an amazing cover. I mean, he does an amazing job covering that song.
Now, where did the song I Do come from that you wrote for Mark Wills?
Well, Keith Stigo called me. He was the vice president of A&R at Mercury Records at the time, where everyone from Sammy Kershaw to Mark Wills to Shania Twain was signed. And he said, Mark Wills needs a hit song. He says, can you come down to NASA and meet with me? Because his whole album has been cut, but he doesn't have that big first single. I said to Keith, well, I've never really tried to write a hit song. I just write songs, and then, you know, for some reason, usually the ones that are the most honest end up being the hits. He said, don't be intellectual. Just get down here. We'll write in the morning. We'll drink margaritas in the afternoon, and we'll go gambling at night. So I flew down to NASA, and we wrote a song a day for 7 days straight. And the seventh day, we wrote I Do Cherish You. So it was one of those rare songs where I was sort of a writer for hire to write that hit. Then I made the demo of the song, and I had a choice. Do I get a country singer to sing the demo, since Mark is a country singer, or do I sing it, even though I'm definitely a pop singer? I decided that I would sing it. So I made the demo, sent it to Keith, didn't hear anything for 3 weeks. I thought I made a bad choice. I shouldn't have done a country. So I called and said, what's going on? I guess I should do a country demo. He said, oh no, the song's already on the charts. It's going to be number one in 4 weeks. So he didn't even bother to tell me that it was already out and skyrocketing up the charts.
Well, for you, what is your songwriting process to write for these types of artists? I talked to Holly Knight, You know, she's in the, you know, the Women's Songwriters Hall of Fame and her massive hits. And the way she wrote was sitting down with someone and really it's like throwing ideas out in the air. Does this make sense? Does this sound right? What is your process?
Well, it changes given the circumstances. So if I'm writing songs by myself, then usually what I'm doing is I'm playing the piano or playing the guitar or going back and forth between those two instruments. And when I find a chord progression that works for me, that feels new and fresh, then the words start coming. But usually the words don't really form till the following day. So the music starts to come before the words. And it's not formulaic, and I'm never really trying to write for an artist. I'm just trying to write. Yes, I have written for artists when I'm writing with the artists. For example, Richard Marx and I wrote with Michael Bolton. So yeah, that we were writing a Michael Bolton song. But generally speaking, I don't do that. Now, if I'm writing with another writer, that's different. I think you have to be really versatile, because sometimes I wrote with a really very gifted and successful Dutch artist named Anouk, and she didn't want me writing any words. I go, well, that's kind of interesting, because I'm pretty good with words. So I would just have to write the music. You know, I'd be strumming, and because I'm always writing words, words would come into my head, and I would just blurt them out, because forgetting I was. And she would come right up to me and put her hand right up against my mouth to shut me up. You know, and you know, but usually I'm sort of working more on the words with a collaboration, and the collaborator might be doing a bit more with the music. You know, again, it really, really varies depending on the context and depending on the writer. Then sometimes you're writing with pop stars who frankly aren't really that good as writers, and you just have to write everything yourself. And I don't mind if that's the case as well. I like being versatile. I like to feel that I can switch from words to music to both. You know, that's what kind of keeps your brain really on fire.
Well, you have written with some of the most iconic people in all the world, but with a career that has spanned six decades, you were inducted into the Canadian Songwriters Hall of Fame. What did that mean to you?
Well, you know, for the most part, I was just highly moved because all my heroes were already in there. Leonard Cohen, Gordon Lightfoot, you know, et cetera, et cetera. They were kind of like the equivalent to my university education, because I went out and saw all these artists when I was a kid. And I didn't realize at that time that part of the process was I was studying. I was learning not only how to be a really strong songwriter, musician, and singer, but also learning about stage presence. I saw Billy Joel when I was 17, and the way he synthesized storytelling into his songs. I saw Harry Chapin before Taxi came out. And again, an amazing storyteller, not just in his songs, but in his in-between patter. And so these were my professors. These were my PhD, you know, songwriting teachers. And so to be in that category alongside them just left me feeling extremely humbled and moved.
Well, what is your most memorable moment in your six-decade career in music?
That's a really interesting question. I've had a lot of memorable, unusual circumstances due to sometimes when we touch. Once I was paid an enormous amount by a stockbroker to meet he and his fiance in Central Park. They were in a horse-driven buggy. I was in one behind them. I was hiding. And then when he was about to ask her to marry him, I had to jump out of my buggy and immediately start singing Sometimes When We Touch right in front of them. It was just sort of hilarious. So I did that. And the woman just thought I was this busker, you know, tramping in on their special private moment. She started swearing at me to get lost. And then when I kept singing, they just started necking furiously and actually getting into some fairly explicit other things. And I ended up feeling like I was like providing the music to some kind of erotic soundtrack to some softcore porn. And I don't know what was the most memorable, and even when I finished the song, even though the guy said it was her favorite song, she still didn't believe I was Dan Hill. She refused to believe it.
Well, didn't you have to show her your driver's license?
Well, what happened was I thought, well, that's funny because my voice is pretty much the same. And he says it's her favorite song of all time. Why wouldn't? So I, what I did is they asked me. He asked me to sign some CDs and photos. So I send that. I give that to both of them. She's looking at the photos, looking at me. Then she realizes I am Dan Hill. Then she asked me to sit beside her in the buggy, and then she asked if she can kiss me. At which time the fiance kind of turns on me and says, "You know that line? At times I'd like to break you and drive you to your knees. I don't like that line. It's advocating violence towards women." And so at that point, I realized I had to take off and scram. So that was one of the funnier moments of my career.
That was a funny moment, definitely in your book. Now, when are we going to get to see, or I should say, when are we going to get to hear the Best of Dan Hill collection?
It's coming out. It's coming out in 2 weeks. Thank you for bringing that up. Yeah.
Well,
it's actually my biggest records of the 70s, believe it or not, before you were born.
Wow. That I cannot wait to get that album when it comes out, because I was reading about it. I knew that it was going to be coming here pretty soon, but to come out in 2 weeks, I cannot wait for that. Hey, ladies and gentlemen, I got to tell you this. Dan Hill is not only an icon and a legend in Canada, but all over the world. We've all sung along with all of his hit songs. And of course, we've all sung Sometimes When We Touch to a Past or Current Love, a reason why it's still one of the top 100 most played songs of all time. You need to head over to danhill.com. Hey, he just let us know that in a couple of weeks, the Best of Dan Hill collection is coming out. So we all need to get that album. And to know more about Dan Hill and read more about him, you have got to get one of the best autobiographies that I have read, I Am My Father's Son. It's an excellent book. It's very intriguing. It's heartfelt and full of a few life lessons. And I have to quote Vanessa Thomas, who is the executive director of the Canadian Songwriters Hall of Fame. And she says that Dan's songs are authentic and intimate. Whether he is singing about love or social injustice, his lyrics resonate as loudly and powerfully as if he were shouting it from the mountains. And that is the gift that Dan, as an artist and a songwriter, and Dan Hill's gift of song will continue to make memories in all of our lives. And Dan, I want to thank you so very much for honoring us with your time and reflection today.
Absolutely, my pleasure. Thank you so much for taking the time to talk to me. It means so much to me.
Well, I will tell you, Dan, that again, all of your songs are embedded into our hearts and our minds. You have created memories for millions of people around the world, and that song continues to do just that. And again, I cannot wait for the Best of Dan Hill collection. And ladies and gentlemen, again, head over to danhill.com, and we will wait with bated breath for the next couple of weeks when that comes out so we can all buy the record. And of course, everyone, you know that I stand firmly on that promise. What do? We buy the music. We don't download for free. We support all of our favorite artists. We support the songwriters who write those songs. And if they go on tour, we support them as well as their crews, because everybody has to get paid. And we need to thank them by buying their music. And again, Dan, you are always welcome back on this show. And had a beautiful time with you.
And me with you. It was a lot of fun. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you. And ladies and gentlemen, I want to thank you for watching and listening. And as for me, I'll see you next time.